Welcome to your deep dive. Today, we're going to be looking at early American film.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, we've got you gave us some excerpts from a book all about the Thanhouser Film Corporation,
Yeah.
and they were active from 1909 to 1917.
Wow.
So kind of a really interesting period.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a period of well, immense innovation and change in the industry.
Yeah.
The average film, was only about 15 minutes long.
Wow. So they had to get a lot done in those 15 minutes.
Absolutely, and they were putting out new films every week.
Wow. Imagine that pressure. And these excerpts aren't just dry facts and figures.
Oh no.
They actually offer like these little glimpses into the lives of the people who built this whole industry from the ground up.
Yeah, it's those individual stories that make history come alive.
Totally. And speaking of individuals, the story like really begins with the founder, Edwin Thanhouser.
Right.
His life before film was, well, let's just say it was anything but straightforward.
It was a winding road. The book mentions he was born in 1865 and moved around a lot with his family.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Like all over the place.
All over. Matamoros, Mexico, Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Wow.
He held all sorts of jobs before he finally found his way to the world of theater.
Huh. That's fascinating. It's like this constant shifting between roles, adapting to new environments. Do you think that like maybe foreshadowed how he approached filmmaking later on?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Thanhouser was never afraid to experiment, to try new things, always adapting, just like he had to in his early life.
Right.
The book highlights his time with the Salvini Company and then, of course, working with Charles Frohman, a big name in American theater.
Oh, yeah, for
He
sure.
even toured with Frohman's productions, gained some valuable experience there.
Oh, yeah, that's great. I was reading that Canadian newspapers had a an interesting time with his last name.
Oh, yeah.
They misspelled it all the time. Thanhouser, Thonhauser, even Thanhausen.
Oh, wow. Makes you wonder if he ever considered just changing it.
Right. But even with the misspellings, critics still like saw his talent shining through.
Exactly. And all that experience really honed his skills, prepared him for the unpredictable world of filmmaking. He took everything he learned from the stage and applied it to the screen.
Yeah, like it was all building up to this. And then he formed the Thanhouser Stock Company,
Right?
managed the Academy Theater in Milwaukee. Imagine splitting a company in two for different productions during Carnival Week back in 1901.
That takes some serious organizational skills.
It does. He even managed the theater from home when he got sick.
Wow.
The book says it was a pretty severe illness, too. That's dedication.
Absolutely.
So we've got this picture of Edwin, adaptable, driven, a real showman at heart. But how did he go from theater to film? That seems like a huge jump.
Well, to understand that, we need to look at what was happening with movies at the time. Theaters were popping up everywhere, often converted spaces. Storefronts, opera houses, you name it.
Yeah, nothing like the fancy movie palaces we have today.
Not even close. Remember Hales Tours?
Oh, yeah. Where people would sit in these mock train cars and watch films with added sound effects.
Exactly. It's a whole different experience.
It really was. And while all this was going on, there was this power struggle happening behind the scenes, right?
Absolutely. The Motion Picture Patents Company, or the Trust, as it was known, they were led by Edison. And we're trying to basically control the whole industry.
Oh, wow.
They'd sue anyone who used equipment that even slightly infringed on their patents.
It was like the Wild West of filmmaking.
It really was. And in the midst of all that chaos, you had the independents fighting for their survival, making innovative and artistic films despite the constant legal threats.
Like folks like D.W. Griffith over at Biograph.
Yeah, exactly. So, with all this going on, how did Edwin even manage to break into the scene?
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering.
Well, it all comes down to one conversation. He was approached by Barry O'Neill.
Okay.
Now, Barry already had some connections in the film world. He had staged plays for Lillian Russell, the famous actress. Yeah. So Barry saw the potential of film and basically said to Edwin, "I'm going to make your films for you."
Wow, what a proposition. Did Edwin just jump at the chance?
Actually, no. At first, he laughed. It was Barry who was already a little bit involved. But Edwin's persistence and, I guess, his vision won him over.
And that was the birth of the Thanhouser Film
Well,
Corporation.
that's right.
That's incredible. So they had their team, but where did they set up shop?
They chose New Rochelle, New York.
Okay.
And, you have to admire Edwin's foresight here. He insisted on having a well-equipped studio right from the start.
Oh, that's smart.
He knew quality was key if they wanted to produce good pictures.
Yeah, that's a philosophy that a lot of studios today could learn from. So they had their studio, their vision. What were some of their first films like?
Well, their debut film, The Actor's Children, got some pretty good reviews.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they praised the quality. But critics also pointed out that it still felt a bit too much like, you know, stage productions.
Right.
They hadn't quite grasped that cinematic style yet.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's that challenge of adapting to a whole new medium, figuring out what works on screen versus what works on stage.
Exactly. But they learned quickly. Their second film, St. Elmo, showed improvement.
Mm-hmm.
And then came The Doctor's Carriage. This one introduced audiences to the adorable Maria Lyne, the Fanhauser Kid.
Ah, yes. The Fanhauser Kid. I was wondering when she'd come up. She was a hit with audiences, right?
Oh, huge hit. She brought a certain charm to their productions. But, you know, even as they found their creative footing, they still faced all sorts of challenges, especially when it came to distribution.
Yeah, talking about that independent film distribution system.
Right.
Which, as I recall, was a bit of a mess back then.
It was a constantly shifting landscape. Don't forget, the Trust controlled most of the major distribution channels.
Mm-hmm.
So the independents had to get, creative.
I bet. So how did Thanhouser get their films out there?
Initially, they just sold their films outright to exchange men. You know, these guys would then turn around and sell them to theaters.
So there was no guarantee of, like, how much they'd make.
It was a risky business, to say the least.
Wow. So they're making these 15-minute films trying to release, like, two or three a week and navigating this crazy distribution system. Sounds exhausting.
It was a constant hustle. And they were producing such a variety of films during this time. I mean, they were growing so rapidly.
Yeah.
There was Value Beyond Price, a real heartwarming story about a pawnbroker who takes in this young girl. And then there's The Early Life of David Copperfield. Their first attempt at adapting Dickens for the screen.
Wow, Dickens on film, that's early.
They even started incorporating real locations into their films.
Oh, cool, like what?
Niagara Falls.
Wow, imagine seeing that on the big screen back then. It must have been magical.
It really was a different era of storytelling.
Mm.
And the person behind a lot of these narratives was an incredibly prolific writer, Lloyd Lonergan.
Okay, now this is interesting. Tell me about this Lloyd Lonergan.
Well, he was married to one of Gertrude Thanhouser's sisters, so there were family ties there.
Yeah.
He was a former Naval Academy student.
Oh, wow.
Became a journalist, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And he was working at the New York Evening World when he started writing scripts for Thanhouser.
Wait, so he had a full-time job and was writing screenplays on the side?
He was. He started out writing one script a week, which is already pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But eventually, he moved closer to the studio and became like a core member of the team. By the end of his career, he claimed to have written over 1,000 scripts.
1,000 scripts? That's mind-blowing. I mean, it really speaks to the sheer volume of content being produced back then.
It does. And it also shows just how important a good writer was to a film company.
Absolutely. But just as things were really taking off for Thanhouser, disaster struck.
The fire.
It almost destroyed everything they built. What a turn of events.
It really was a tragedy. It happened on a Monday afternoon, January 13th, 1913. Ironically, the studio was practically empty.
Oh, really?
Yeah. A lot of the crew were in California or on location out in the Midwest.
So most of the key players were actually out of town when it happened.
They were, including Edwin and Gertrude Thanhouser. They were on an extended trip to Europe. Back in New Rochelle, you had James Cruz, Marguerite Snow, and a few others working on a new film.
Oh, wow. So what caused the fire?
Well, they suspected it was an overheated glue pot.
A glue pot? Seriously? It's incredible how something so small could cause so much damage.
It is. The building, which was actually a converted skating rink, was completely destroyed. Films, costumes, equipment, all gone.
What a loss.
The estimated loss was between $75,000 and $100,000.
A fortune back then.
A fortune. And to make things even worse, they didn't have insurance on the building or its contents.
Oh, no. That's awful.
It was a devastating blow, for sure. But amidst all the chaos, there are these almost funny stories, you know? Like the studio truck, this old clunker that everybody hated, they actually pushed it back into the fire after initially saving it.
Well, I guess they got rid of it one way or another.
Right. And then you have Marguerite Snow, their leading lady. Yep. She lost her entire wardrobe.
Oh, no. That's terrible.
She claimed it was worth $3,000. And James Cruz said he lost 50 suits.
50 suits.
Just paints his picture of, like, total pandemonium.
It does. It sounds like something straight out of a movie. But, you know, what's striking is how they responded to this disaster. They didn't give up.
Not at all. The book mentions Charles J. Haidt, the vice president, really stepping up and taking charge.
Oh, yeah.
He was a force to be reckoned with. Within weeks, he'd secured a temporary space and got production back up and running. They even released a new film, Her Fireman, just a few days after the fire.
Wow. Talk about a quick turnaround, but it sounds like Haidt wasn't content with just like getting back to normal. He had bigger plans.
He did. He wanted to build this incredible state-of-the-art studio, a real showpiece.
I'm intrigued. What did he have in mind?
He envisioned this sprawling campus with a dark studio, multiple stages, luxurious dressing rooms, even a restaurant for the employees.
That sounds more like a Hollywood studio than something from the early 1900s.
He was ahead of his time. He even tried to get tax breaks from New Rochelle to help finance the project.
So did they get the funding?
Unfortunately, no. The city council rejected the tax breaks.
Oh, no.
But even without that financial boost, they decided to stay in New Rochelle.
So they still went ahead with building a new studio.
They did. They found a new location, a former garage, actually, and transformed it into a functional studio. It wasn't as extravagant as Haidt's original vision, but it allowed them to keep making films. Of course, the fire caused a lot of disruption to their release schedule.
Yeah, I can only imagine they were releasing multiple films a week.
It was a logistical nightmare, trying to reschedule everything, dealing with lost films.
I bet.
But they adapted, shifted gears, kept moving forward. And through it all, they continued to experiment, to refine their craft.
So even after the setback, they were still pushing boundaries, evolving as filmmakers.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And this all coincided with a big shift in the industry as a whole.
What's that?
The rise of the star system.
Ah, yes. This is when actors like Florence Labadie and James Cruz start to become household names.
Exactly. And Thanhouser embraced this trend, promoting their stars, you know, capitalizing on their popularity. Florence Labadie, especially, she became a huge draw. And it's interesting how they started incorporating like real life events into their narratives.
Oh, yeah. Like they were almost predicting our modern day obsession with ripped from the headlines stories.
Right. They were tapping into what the public was already fascinated by.
You mentioned a film about a hot air balloon accident.
Yeah. There were all these stories about hot air balloon accidents in the news at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they took that and wove it into their fictional world.
Wow, that's cool. So they were experimenting with different storylines, but were they still making those 15-minute films?
They were doing a mix. Still some one-reelers. But they started venturing to longer formats as well.
Oh, cool. Like what?
Well, there was Jess, a three-reel adaptation of a H. Rider Haggard novel.
Oh, wow.
But it was the million-dollar mystery, released in 1914, that really captured the public's imagination.
Ah, yes. The serial that had everyone on the edge of their seats waiting for the next installment.
Exactly. Each episode ended on a cliffhanger, leaving the audience wanting more. And it was perfectly timed, you know, because movie serials were just becoming all the rage.
It's like they were riding the wave of a new trend.
They were. And that success led to some internal changes within the Mutual Film Corporation, which Danhauser was a part of.
Right. So Charles J. Haidt, he actually became president of Mutual at this point, didn't he?
He did in 1914. And under his leadership, they formed new divisions, acquired other studios. They were really expanding their operations.
It sounds like they were building a real empire.
They were. But empires often come with their own set of challenges, especially in an industry that was still so new and unpredictable.
Very true. So what were some of the hurdles they faced?
Well, there were these growing pains within the company. Tensions were brewing, especially with Harry E. Aitken.
Okay, I remember reading about him. He was one of the founders of Mutual, right?
He was. And he'd been instrumental in their early success. But he was also pushing for more ambitious projects.
What kind of projects?
Well, he was a big supporter of D.W. Griffith and was pushing for Mutual to back Griffith's controversial masterpiece, The Birth of a Nation.
Ah, yes. That film was a landmark moment in cinema history.
It was. Both for its artistic achievements and the controversy it generated.
For sure.
And Aitken's insistence on supporting it ultimately led to his departure from Mutual.
So they lost one of their key figures. And then shortly after that, tragedy struck again.
You're talking about Charles J. Haidt's death.
Yeah. It was a car accident, right?
It was. In August of 1915, a huge blow for the company, losing their leader at such a pivotal time. And, you know, the industry itself was undergoing this massive transformation. Feature films were becoming the dominant format, and Thanhouser was struggling to keep pace.
Right. And then Edwin Thanhouser returned to the company in 1915. But he was walking into a very different world than the one he'd left behind.
He was. What would he do?
It must have been a difficult situation to walk into. The company in turmoil, the industry changing so rapidly. Did he try to save it?
Oh, he did. Tried to maintain the quality that Sennheiser was known for. Adapt to that evolving market. But it was tough. In 1916, they made a pretty bold decision. They left Mutual.
Oh, wow. Why'd they leave?
They weren't happy with the direction Mutual was heading.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they wanted more control, you know, over their own destiny.
Yeah, that makes sense.
They signed a new distribution deal with Pathé Exchange. It was a gamble, but they were betting on themselves.
That independent spirit coming through again. But the industry was getting even more competitive by then, wasn't it?
It was. The big studios were starting to emerge. And Sennheiser, they weren't that trailblazing force anymore. They were still making those one-reelers and features, but they were having trouble finding their place.
So the magic was fading.
In a way, yeah. And in 1917, they made another big move. This time, relocating to Jacksonville, Florida.
Jacksonville? Why Jacksonville?
Well, back then, it was seen as this, like, new frontier for filmmaking.
Mm.
Warm climate, diverse locations, seemed like it had a lot of potential.
Interesting. But it didn't work out.
Not really. They released their final film, The Woman in White, in August of 1917. And just a few months later, they closed the studio.
What a bittersweet ending to such an amazing story. But they accomplished so much in such a short time.
They did. It's a reminder that sometimes success is fleeting. But what really matters is the impact you make along the way.
I think what really stands out to me is the human element of it all. The actors losing their costumes in the fire, the director rushing to meet deadlines, the constant struggle to balance art and business. It wasn't just about films, it was about people's lives.
Exactly. And that's what makes history so compelling. It's those individual stories within the larger narrative.
And as we wrap up this deep dive into the Sennheiser Film Corporation, what's the key takeaway for you?
Their resilience. They face lawsuits, a devastating fire, internal conflicts, a constantly changing industry, and they just kept going.
Yeah.
They adapted, innovated, never lost their passion.
It's a great reminder that success is rarely a straight line. It's messy, unpredictable, sometimes fleeting, but the journey, the challenges, and the impact we make along the way, that's what matters.
Absolutely. What about for you?
You know, I keep coming back to Edwin Sennheiser and how he just walked away from the film industry seemingly without any regrets. Makes you wonder if there's a lesson there for all of us.
It does. Maybe it's about knowing when to let go.
Yeah.
He dedicated himself to filmmaking. He achieved success. But he was also able to recognize when it was time for a new chapter.
Yeah. And it's not like he just disappeared. He pursued other passions.
Yeah.
The book mentions he became an art collector.
He did. And it's fascinating, you know. He gravitated towards paintings from the Barbizon School. They were known for their realistic depictions of rural life, landscapes. It's almost like he was searching for something more grounded after years in the whirlwind of filmmaking.
That's a beautiful thought, finding peace and inspiration in art. Did he ever miss filmmaking, though? Ever think about making a comeback?
It doesn't seem so. He rarely talked about his time in the industry. And when asked if he'd ever return, he simply said, "I have done with my life exactly what I wanted." There's a real sense of contentment there.
It sounds like he found a level of fulfillment that many of us strive for. So as we reflect on the Sennheiser legacy, what do you think their biggest contribution to film history was?
They were pioneers, pushing boundaries, experimenting with storytelling, helping elevate filmmaking to an art form. And they left behind this body of work that still offers us a glimpse into those early days of cinema.
It's easy to forget that they were essentially inventing the language of film. Figuring it all out as they went along, their story really speaks to that ingenuity and passion.
And the resilience. Always bouncing back, reinventing themselves. That's something we can all learn from.
For our listener who has been on this journey with us through the world of Sennheiser, what's the one question we should leave them with?
What if Edwin Sennheiser, with his unique background and his adaptability, had entered the film industry today? How would he approach filmmaking in this digital age? It's something to think about.
It really is. It makes us think about how those pioneers of early cinema would navigate the world of filmmaking today. Their stories continue to inspire and challenge us. Well, this has been an incredible journey. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the Sennheiser Film Corporation.
It's been my pleasure. And as always, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep that love of learning alive.
Until next time.